What a week. Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air. It's the week of January 29th, 2016, and you're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory near Vancouver. My name is Neil Janssen.
And I'm Mayan Kreitzman. You can and should check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for detailed stories of some of what we talk about on the air. And this is especially true this week, since Neil and I stayed up till 3 a.m. on Tuesday night to break what is probably the story of the year for us.
And it's only January.
The unexpected and seemingly unintended release of unprecedented details of the problems in UBC's leadership prior to Arvind Gupta's resignation last summer. There's a full write-up on the blog, and if that whets your appetite, there's also an awesome archive full of 9 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
This week on the show, there's only one story we can start with. That's Arvind Sanity. We've got Dr. Gupta on the show with us as our interview guest today, but before that, we'll also hear from Student Senator Gurbir Sangha and Faculty Association President Mark McLean.
On with the show. We'll just note that this has been a fast-paced week for news, and our conversation with our news panelist Gurbir took place before we knew that we would be talking to Dr. Gupta.
And before Dr. Gupta had spoke out publicly himself.
Right. So without further ado, let's go back to the studio. For news this week, we have Gurbir Sangha with us in the studio. Gurbir is a senator at the UBC Vancouver campus. He's also a fifth-year student in the Faculty of Arts. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on today. Exciting times.
Yep, it's a good week to be on the news segment.
The blockbuster story of this week, of course, is that on Monday, UBC finally released the long-awaited document dump about Gupta's resignation. There were interesting records in there about expenses, correspondence with the provincial government, and lots of emails back and forth between former President Arvind Gupta and former board chair John Montalbano. For the most part, though, the interesting documents were redacted in their entirety. Without that information, it was possible to get some hints about what had gone on, but not really any clear picture about what had happened in the lead-up to the resignation.
So that was up until Tuesday night, and on Tuesday night, that paucity of information in the FOI release turned into gold when it turned out that supplementary documents that were attached to the main release were available in full unredacted form. And the story that comes out of those documents, which Neil and I wrote up late on Tuesday night and broke in the mainstream media the next morning, answered many of the same questions that people have been fruitlessly asking since the resignation of Arvind Gupta from the UBC presidency on August 7th. In this dramatic formal correspondence between the board chair, John Montalbano, and Arvind, the deteriorating relationship between the Board of Governors and the President is exposed in painstaking detail. More accurately, maybe the Board's long list of complaints about virtually every aspect of Arvind's leadership that you can think of are discussed, as well as Gupta's responses to those criticisms. The correspondence is from late May and early June, and while it would definitely indicate that a crisis was at hand already at that time, there's still no smoking gun, as it were, that unequivocally shows what happened to cause the early August resignation almost 2 months later. So, Gurbir, you spent some of the night looking through those 800-plus pages. What jumped out at you?
There obviously was a lot in the initial documents that UBC released that was redacted, but I do feel like you could pull away some hints of tension. So when we take a look at the documents that were leaked, essentially, that weren't redacted, and we see that allegedly Arvind did not have the best relationship with deans, there were problems with the staff, his attitude, or the way he worked with other executives, it is a really damning picture. It's really unfortunate.
This is all, of course, according to the author of those complaints, which are this sort of sub-subcommittee of the Board of Governors.
Which is definitely troubling. Just taking a look at all the informal meetings and the correspondences and the requests, can we meet, you know, two-on-one, one-on-one, it seemed peculiar to me. It seemed like a little bit of micromanaging was happening, or maybe a lot of micromanaging for that matter.
Maybe we can just take a little step back before we dig more into the content. We were on Twitter today, and a lot of people seemed a little confused about how these documents got released and how we found them. Neil, so you were just perusing the UBC subreddit, as is your wont, last night around midnight when I got a message from you, right?
Yeah, I believe the text of the message was, holy fuck. And then we got to work and started reading the documents and quickly managed to verify that they were real. And then we just got to writing the context and the narrative of how this all happened with the new information that we had.
Right. But basically what happened with these documents was that on this subreddit, really, God bless the nerds of Reddit, somebody under the handle Fling Meow, Fling Meow, he's a true tsar.
Or she
is a true mensch. They just mentioned that they had extracted a bunch of attachments to this PDF file that came out of the Freedom of Information requests. I don't think most people know that you can attach other files to PDFs, but you can. The document itself, of course, was heavily redacted, but all of the attachments to the document were there in their entirety. And it seems that this is not a disgruntled employee who did this on purpose. It's just somebody who noticed those attachments and decided to post them.
If they had made the same mistake on some minor file that didn't have to do with this resignation of the president,
Nobody would have ever noticed.
But because this was such a big deal, so many people looked at it, and all it takes is one person to think, maybe I'll look to see if there's attachments here. And of course, this had been downloaded on all sorts of people's computers, so they really couldn't take it back at that point.
It would be interesting to see if maybe a lawsuit comes out of this. That's the first thing I thought of, because it feels like now maybe the non-disclosure doesn't hold as much weight as Arvin would have liked it to, because it's all out in the open.
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out, what Arvin is going to do next, because is he going to speak out, or is he just going to, like you said, bring a lawsuit of some sort and try to seek some sort of damages? No one's coming out of this looking good.
No, and certainly UBC would be vulnerable to a lawsuit, to multiple lawsuits now for breaching that contract and for privacy violation.
And of course, UBC released a short statement simply saying that they're aware that these documents had been released and wouldn't be saying anything, and that they've launched another investigation, so add one more to the tally of investigations currently going on at UBC.
But it seems like the investigation is going to be limited into, you know, how did the mistake get made with leaving the attachments on the FOI file? It's not going to be an investigation into all of the troubling content of those documents.
No. And shall we get into those? So,
yeah.
So, man, I personally love your writing style sometimes because of the way you describe the May 18th letter from John Montalbano to Arvind Gupta as appointed an unrelenting thrashing, detailing nearly every aspect of leadership style and management skill that you can think of as deficient.
I like my adjectives sometimes. But yeah, to get into the thick of it, I mean, the content of those complaints had to do with communication style, which a claim was that Arvind's communication style was very confrontational and divisive, lack of connection to public affairs, hasty dismissals of the executives without having any backup plan, fear from the executive team over losing their jobs, incompetent and clueless office staff in the president's office, and on and on and on. Oh, and importantly, also disregard for the authority of the Board of Governors and a deep dissatisfaction with Arvind's attitude and relationship with the board, which they thought was extremely dismissive.
It wasn't the most flattering painting of Arvind. And perhaps it was that the board felt that Arvind disregarded them, or at least members of the board that went and confronted him about this. I don't believe it might be fair to speak on behalf of the entire board. How much they knew about what was happening as an entirety might have to wait to be seen.
Well, exactly. And that's one of the main issues we still have to grapple with. You know, like, these complaints come from a small number of people, and they don't necessarily represent the whole board, and they don't represent a formal board structure. It's this ad hoc group of people that are mostly in these conversations with Arvind about his performance. Whether they represent the whole board, and even if it did, if that represents a sort of consensus or valid evaluation from the whole UBC community, is highly suspect. Nonetheless, these complaints do not look good. And Gupta's response to them is a little tepid, honestly. It's a little defiant, but it's not all that convincing either.
Well, I think the problems he was supposed to fix is hard to actually address in a way that is practical. When the problem is that you're just communicating weirdly, all you can say is that I will communicate better. But then they say that that wouldn't be specific enough in terms of how he's going to address these things.
What do you think about this sort of sequence of events? And you dug into the names and groups of people that were involved in various emails and various off-book meetings that took place.
Well, it seems to be a small group of governors. So Lindsay Gordon, the chancellor, John Montalbano, the former chair, Greg Peet, who's the chair of the Finance and Property Committee, Alice LaBerge, who was the vice chair and is the acting chair, as well as Doug Mitchell, who is the chair of the Governance Committee. And so this is a group of fairly, in their eyes, powerful people. Who form part of the executive committee, but not all of the executive committee. And they seem to have just taken it upon themselves to have their own little meetings to discuss these things without feeling the need to inform anyone else. So you've been on Senate, and of course the president serves as the chair of Senate. Do you think there's any fairness to their criticisms of his leadership style?
I don't know if I would be the best person to comment on Arvind's style, just because my only interactions with him through Senate, well, the extent of that is one meeting before... We ended for the summer, and then Martha came in. But when I got a look around the room and tried to, you know, gauge for how people were feeling, it didn't seem as receptive or as warm as it is with Martha. She commands a room better anyway, so...
Well, one thing that a couple of people mentioned to me is that certainly the complaints about Arvind's leadership style are diametrically different than some other anecdotal evidence. I mean, Jennifer Birtle's blog post comes to mind where she describes him as quite a good listener and as having a rather inclusive leadership style that isn't particularly domineering. And if you just come to those letters and read them, they seem pretty convincing. You're like, holy wow, this sounds bad. But you got to remember, that's a small group of people that are saying this, and we don't really know or understand how many other people in the academic leadership of the university felt the same way.
So what I found interesting in the ones that we published last night is that, at least at the beginning, John seems to go out of his way to say that he really feels it's in the best interests of the university for Arvind to stay on as president. And so he's obviously intending these criticisms to be constructive. I would disagree that they're constructive as ways for him to improve and stay on and succeed. So do you think just what happened in July is that they decided that was no longer what's in the best interest of the university, and that they might have really felt that they were fulfilling their duty as governors to not have him there?
It's really hard to say. I mean, when you look at those letters, if you just think of more of the same, that would be enough. I don't think another big crisis would have been necessary if it was just a sort of stalemate. But maybe there was something else that was the last straw. Who knows?
Any just tidbits from the FOI package that you noticed, Gavir?
Yeah.
The ice bucket challenge, for example. I don't know if you spotted that one out.
Yeah.
But where...
How could you not? It went on for like 50 pages.
Where, yeah, John is just like, you owe me one. And Arvind hits him with the, oh, I owe you many, but who's counting amongst friends? And, you know, here we are in 2016 still talking about how messy this ended.
Yeah, I would say the one that I noticed is in the June 4th letter from John Montalbano, in which he says, "No aspects of the University Act are to be ignored at your discretion, only at the discretion of the board," which is completely insane because he's asserting that the board has the discretion to just ignore the law when it feels like.
Yeah, that was a bizarre, bizarre line that popped out.
It's been a crazy week, and we've learned a lot.
It's been a crazy week. We were about to publish this sad little post with the scraps that we could have gleaned from the redacted version when this landed in our lap, so it's been interesting.
All right, so for a short second story, last week at Senate, there was a motion passed where if you want to apply for med school at UBC, you no longer require science prerequisites. What's that about, Gervier?
The goal of removing the science requirements was to essentially remove a barrier that might have been obstructing otherwise worthwhile candidates or people who would succeed in the profession, in the medical profession, from entering the field.
And my understanding is that there's data to back up the idea that doctors that come from the arts or humanities make great doctors.
Absolutely. When I was talking to Karan, who's the med program student senator, he explained to me that they really appreciate the sentiment behind the motion in the sense that it's not just a background in the sciences that makes you a good doctor. You also have to be a great critical thinker, and you can absolutely have that from other programs.
I mean, it makes sense to all of us. It seemed to be a big deal when it went to the Senate floor. Why were people so worked up about it?
The pushback comes from predominantly from figures within the med program. So one hesitancy that students had was that there's a new curriculum that has just been implemented for the med program. The first year of that curriculum is just being completed now. So students worry because these are going to be their future peers and colleagues about the impact that maybe not having a science background might have on their ability to succeed in this new curriculum moving forward. So while they were behind the motion in its spirit, they would have liked to see the curriculum first be run through completely and then perhaps implemented. Further, there is a necessity to have a proficiency in sciences in the med program just by virtue of what you're working with. So the professors were concerned, some of them were anyway, that the lack of background in the basic sciences might lead to a very steep learning curve or difficulties for the students entering the program.
Okay. And this is happening. It ended up passing.
Yeah, so it did end up passing, and it'll be implemented for the 2017-18 winter session.
The last story we thought we might mention is about an Aboriginal professor fighting UBC after being denied tenure. Lorna June McHugh was a tenure-track faculty member in the Allard School of Law, and she was not given tenure, I think, after a decade or more of working here because she didn't publish anything in peer-reviewed journals.
The argument is that she's engaging in alternate forms of scholarship through the oral traditions of her Indigenous background, and that she is doing research, she is spreading knowledge, and is teaching people. It's just not in the narrow format of peer-reviewed journals that UBC would like.
And so this opens a huge can of worms about how different forms of knowledge that aren't recognized in the traditional academic reward structure can be used and can be recognized in this university. What do you think about this, Gurveer?
I believe that there's a lot that we don't know at the moment that would factor into how I view this engagement between this professor who was dismissed and the university. For example, I'm not aware of how much alternative academic content she produced, if she had an extensive conference history or extensive non-peer-reviewed literature. If she did, it would have been interesting to see if she considered reaching a compromise with the faculty. Actually, it was mentioned in the National Post article that she received an email early in her career from the dean stating that in order to achieve tenure track, the expectation is 5 to 6 peer-reviewed pieces of literature. So if this is something that inherently clashed with how she wanted to pursue academia, it's something that could have been addressed much earlier in her career. UBC even provided her 8 months in 2008, I believe, to work on this literature. And she did produce something. It was 8 pages, but it was non-peer reviewed. So I definitely feel like we need to know more.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and we'll be continuing to think about it. We'll be interviewing Professor Link Kessler in a month or so around UBC's Aboriginal strategy and how Indigenous knowledge can be integrated into the university in fundamental ways. He is the director of the First Nations House of Learning, and he's also been instrumental in UBC's engagement with various First Nations issues. So hopefully we'll be able to learn more about this. Thank you, Gurveer Sangha, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Last question. Straight coming to block party?
Who knows?
Why would Gurveer know the answer to that?
So you're talking to Mr. Hotline Bling here.
Really? Oh my gosh.
I'm not answering that phone call. Sorry, Neil. You're not getting an answer out of me.
I'm sure the answer is no, but yeah.
I mean,
why are you such a pessimist?
We can hope. You never know.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion.
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at CITR. So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
We were curious to hear what Mark McLean, president of the UBC Faculty Association, would have to say, so we reached him by phone on Wednesday. So note that this is before Arvind Gupta had started speaking out publicly, and also before the Faculty Association released their letter calling for an external review of the board, both of which happened on Thursday.
We're joined on the phone by Mark McLean, who's the president of the UBC Faculty Association. We wanted to ask you, Mark, what are your reactions to the story that broke today?
I was sort of shocked and concerned that there had been such a mishandling of what should have been confidential documents, and then the content of them also, frankly, I found shocking. The Faculty Association, since the resignation of the president last August, had very deep concerns over sort of a lack of evidence for due process in Dr. Gupta's resignation.
Do you have some mixed feelings about this? Because on the one hand, it is a breach of contract and a violation of privacy, but on the other hand, this is providing a lot more information about all of those processes, whether they were correct or not, than we've had previously, and answering a lot of those lingering questions that everyone in the UBC community has had over the last 6 months.
I think it's unfortunate that what we have is what I'll call some snippets of more information without any context and point of fact, without any real commentary from either the board or from Dr. Gupta. I guess I'd be interested to hear more from each side.
Do you think we're going to hear from Arvind?
Well, I think it's more likely now that the leak has broken the confidentiality barrier, if you will. What we have is effectively a secret set of processes by which the university is governed. That's probably the biggest concern I have, is all of this demonstrates the level of secrecy, the lack of transparency, and hence the lack of accountability that the board has publicly.
Even though John Montalbano's gone, everyone else on that email chain is still there. Greg Peet's still on the board. Lindsay Gordon's still our chancellor. Does the whole board need to go? Does there need to be basically a bulk turnover of the board to get rid of the rot?
We're governed in this secret way, and whether it's these individuals or other members of the board, until we change the actual governance of the institution, we're in danger of having incidents like this repeat and repeat.
How can the board possibly regain trust and credibility as a responsive institution when it's clear that they have no qualms with lying directly to the university community?
I have a very difficult time seeing the board recover credibility. I just can't picture any scenario in which this board regains the trust of the university community and frankly, the public at large.
Mark, anyway, thank you for talking to us over the phone, and we'll be keeping in touch with you over the next days as maybe another shoe drops soon. As you just heard, we were wondering together with Mark McLean whether Dr. Gupta was going to break his silence. And
he did, in a big way.
Yeah, this morning he went on a media blitz and did a bunch of interviews, and we got to speak with him on Thursday afternoon as well. We've got former President Gupta here on the line with us, and we will jump right into the juicy stuff. Dr. Gupta, who on the board should resign?
Well, you know, I think that it's very important that whenever we're doing evaluation of anyone, we put a proper process in place. It's not about who I think should resign or not resign. We should be putting a process to evaluate performance by everyone, including board members, and then make sure it's well-structured, make sure it's systematic, and make sure that they know what their expectations are going into it, so that when we do that evaluation, there are no surprises, and really should be a constructive process.
And you mentioned that there was a formal evaluation process built into your contract, but that wasn't actually implemented.
That's right. My contract called for a formal evaluation of my performance at the end of the year, and that would have been a time where I and the the relevant board committee could have sat down and agreed on how that performance takes place. The first step, of course, is to look at the goals that have been set for me for the year and see if I had accomplished those, to look at where maybe there needs to be some course adjustments, what should be the goals for the second year. But also, as part of that process, one can develop a mechanism to stakeholder consultation. What are the stakeholders to consult on? What types of issues? And how do we get a representative sample of stakeholders?
So you mentioned that board members should be subject to constructive review, I guess. But who would do that? Because they're not accountable to anyone, or at least the provincially appointed ones aren't accountable to anyone on campus. So who would actually conduct that review?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent question. And when I say that we need to look at the governance structure of UBC, those are the types of questions that we need to ask. At the end of the day, we are a provincial university. So it's the province of British Columbia that gives a mandate to the university to operate, but there's also independence. In other words, the faculty, the students, and the staff are charged with helping in the governance of the university. So I think we need to have that dialogue. What is the proper governance model? How do we hold people accountable that are part of that governance model? How is leadership taken on the university? And then how do we evaluate performance across all the different aspects of governance?
How do you think the prospects are looking for UBC in finding a new president with the conflict between you and the board coming to light in such a detailed way in the last few days?
Again, you know, I hate to make it about us versus them or, you know, one side versus another, and that's unfortunately what these documents look like. The reality is, yes, the university has gone through a painful experience. Beyond my resignation, we've seen people feeling hurt and people feeling not listened to and people feeling that the university is not living up to its ideals. We've seen all this. My question is, what did we learn from this? And what did we take on board to make sure we're improving the institution? You know, I've never been asked by the board, Arvin, what happened? You know, do you come and sit with us and tell us from your perspective what happened?
Well, that might be a good time to ask you what happened in July. Despite all the information that's come out recently, that still remains a fairly big question mark. What happened in that weekend in July?
Well, I can tell you what I know, but there may be many parts of this that I don't know. So I just tell you what I know. What I was told was that an ad hoc committee of the board was formed. That committee met. I don't know how often it met. I don't know what was discussed. Obviously never invited. That committee determined that I did not have their confidence to continue leading the university. And at that point, I realized I had only one of two options. Either I could resign and hope that the board would find leadership that they could all come together under, or I could essentially challenge the authority of this group of board members. My first question when I was told this is it possible to have a full board discussion about this? Can I come to a full board meeting so we can talk about this together? And I was told that that wouldn't be possible, that only if sufficient numbers of board members wanted to see me would I be invited to any kind of discussion with the board. And so given that those avenues were closed to me and I didn't believe a public airing of grievances was in the best interest of the university, I felt the only choice that would keep the university going forward was for me to resign.
Do you think that the other board members were aware of that ad hoc group?
Well, I can't speak for others. I have been told by some board members they were not aware of this, but it's hard for me to know who was aware of exactly what that was going on. You know, earlier that summer, when I learned that some of the formal board committees and subset of formal board committees had met without me, I did start asking the question, is it proper governance for a member of a committee to be not invited to a committee meeting, not to even know that a committee is meeting, because I am a member of all committees of the board. And I have to say that one of the things I reflect on is that I didn't push harder on those types of questions. Hmm. I didn't challenge even committees that were formal committees of the board meeting without me. It's all hindsight of 2020. But when I saw that some of the, what I felt were proper governance steps weren't being properly taken, maybe that was a time for me to start challenging what was going on.
Well, what's your general reflection on these sort of ad hoc informal cabals of certain board members meeting and making decisions and critiques about your presidency and probably decisions about other issues too outside of the formal structure of the board?
Well, I have to say, I don't know what was discussed, so I don't want to, you know, speculate on what these committees were talking about. I do think that we have to visit this issue. Of course, the University Act gives the board very, very broad powers, and it needs to, because if something is going amiss, the board needs to be able to take remedial action.
Now, on the University Act, one interesting thing in the, or I guess not in the FOI disclosure, but hidden in the documents, was something that John Montalbano noted, which was that you don't have the discretion to violate or go against the University Act. Only the board does, which is an extremely strange thing to say, because, of course, the board does not have the ability to violate the University Act either. Do you think that was a typo, or is that actually the attitude that he had?
I did see that, and I remember seeing it earlier. It's hard for me to imagine that someone would really believe that that's the case, that they're beyond and above the law. I will say that I believe that we all abide by a set of rules that we're given, and I always believe that I'm governed by the University Act. I always believe the board is governed by the University Act. The reality is the University Act in places can be interpreted in different ways because it needs to give the board some discretion in how to act if they feel there's a major problem in the university, which doesn't mean that the people taking those actions are not accountable. And I think that's where we're getting to. How do you make sure that everyone stays accountable? Who are people accountable to?
Arvind, will you be taking legal action against UBC? They've breached the confidentiality agreement that you guys have.
I'm laughing a little bit because I'm amazed how many people ask me that question. I went to bed Tuesday night thinking about the different projects I want to do and what I can contribute to our university and to our province. And I woke up Wednesday morning to an early morning phone call saying we have a huge problem. And I've spent from Wednesday morning till this phone call thinking about how to at least give a more balanced view on what was released. I have spent no time thinking beyond that about these kinds of questions.
So what have you been up to in the last 6 months? There's been a lot of reported Arvind Gupta sightings around town.
Yeah, and I noticed that you don't mind reporting them on UBC Insiders. Well, I've had a lot of time to reflect. I'm doing some interesting work at the University of Toronto. You may know I did my PhD there, so I know lots of people in the department. I'm on some government panels. Had a chance to put some more time and energy into those. And I've worked with some industry associations on thinking about how they can get their members to be more focused on research and innovation. So I've had lots of interesting projects on the go, and I've really enjoyed them.
You mentioned the early morning phone call on Wednesday telling you about this new information that had come out. How have you been feeling since then? This must be difficult for you.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of thoughts that go through your head. I give up a lot of what I was doing to come and become the president of UBC, and it's been very difficult on my family. My wife actually scaled back her practice quite a bit, her medical practice. UBC is her alma mater, and she wanted to give back to the universities. So the first thought is, oh, it's all coming back. You know, we're being brought back in to these kinds of issues that we were trying to let go of. At the same time, both my wife and I are so passionate about UBC. We just love the university. We want the university to succeed. And we said, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for us to learn something. And so let's not bemoan that this happened. Let's say that, you know, as we've been sitting at home thinking, why aren't people asking to learn from what took place? Why isn't the board and the senior leadership saying, let's figure out what went wrong? Maybe this actually will open that door and people will start asking these questions. If we don't value transparency and openness, we cannot expect it from others.
Should I understand that you would have been happy to provide more information about the circumstances before and during your resignation, and that it was the board that didn't want to?
Well, I don't know if the board wanted to or not. All I know is that no one from the board contacted me and said, let's sit down and find out what happened. You know, in any organization, it would be normal. There's a transition like this to try to figure out with the people involved what really took place. I am amazed that nobody, you know, the board didn't contact me and said, Arvind, we really would like your perspective on what happened so we can learn. I'm amazed the Presidential Search Committee didn't say, you know, we want to make sure that we support the next president, and so we want to know what happened with the previous president. If I was applying for this job, that's the first thing I'd ask. But without getting my perspective, how would they answer such a question?
I mean, the answer that people have been giving over and over again when we've been asking those kinds of questions is just that there's, you know, this legal agreement in place and that they can't provide any details.
But of course, you know, legal agreements are not meant to preclude doing the right thing. So there's always ways. So, for example, if the board had contacted me and said, would you provide comments in confidence? Would you be willing to say that, you know, the agreement you signed doesn't apply? Mm-hmm. Because I did sign an agreement when I took the job. The agreement doesn't apply for the discussion we're going to have. That's a conversation that people can have with each other. And when you start using legal agreements to stop the right thing from happening, then you already know there's a certain amount of dysfunctionality in the system.
Did you feel any sense of relief when these documents came out and the opportunity for you to open up kind of came up?
I'm not sure relief would be the right word. I just realized it's an opportunity, and that's how I'm taking this. Let's take this opportunity to do a better job.
One of the most tricky topics that's come up in connection with your leadership is the fact that you're one of the only visible minorities that's sort of at the top. And there's research that suggests that women and minorities that have certain leadership characteristics are not rewarded for those in the same way that white men would be. Did you feel like there was any racial or prejudicial element to the way that you were treated at UBC?
When you ask this question, we're all thinking about Jennifer Birdall's blog in the back of our minds. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to put that out there, so we may as well say it. I got to know Professor Birdall fairly well during my year of being a president. In fact, often the university would organize panel discussions and have me and Jennifer on stage together discussing exactly these kinds of issues. And I think it's also amazing that someone like her felt that suppressed in expressing her views, because...
No, but asking you about your personal experience, though.
I'll get to that. And so, not that I feel it's great that she's suppressed, but the fact that we can learn from that. Now, when you're very close to a situation, it's really hard to see this kind of thing. I've never said, oh, I am being subjected to racism and therefore not being given opportunities. I've been given fabulous opportunities, including the opportunity to leave this university. But I'm just too close to the situation, and I'm not an expert to know what actually is the cause and effect. You need to really have someone who's an expert on this being able to look at it from a little bit of a distance. Of course, now we know a lot more than we did in August, whatever, the 7th or 9th that she wrote her blog. So I think it's a really interesting question for her. How does she interpret what's happened since then? Maybe she has a very different view now that she's seen more evidence, or maybe she doesn't. I don't know. I haven't talked with her about it.
Dr. Gupta, we thank you very wholeheartedly for speaking with us today. It's probably been a long day for you.
Nice talking with you.
There's so much to debrief about this week. I feel like we have all of these different pieces that we sort of want to put together and create a bit of a story out of it.
Really? I just like to get some sleep.
Yeah, I think I'm a little tired too. Too much refreshing on Twitter. But how does this all come together for you as a story right now?
Well, it's just everything is finally out in the open. Everyone, when they first got that email that Dr. Gupta had resigned to go back to his academic career, everyone knew there had to be more to it. He doesn't just decide out of the blue that he wants to stop being president. And while he did confirm that it was his choice to resign, it's clear that that was done under quite a bit of duress.
So he basically explained to us in the interview that he was given a choice between resigning and essentially operating in a hostile environment and trying to push forward and push through the resistance of these key board members who, it seems like, kind of hold all the power in their little hands.
And that's a question I would definitely have for board members is, did they know about this? Had other board members seen those May memos? And what did they think of them? Or did they only learn about them this week as well?
For me, it's sort of divided into two. One is the content of the critiques against President Gupta and the content of his vision for the university. Why was that creating so much resistance within the administrative layers, if it was? And whatever legitimate conflicts would have existed within the university ranks around his leadership and his change in vision. And the other thing that this opens up is the extreme opacity of these board processes. You know, this is something that we talk about a lot and that Neil has reported on a lot on the blog over the years. But it takes a high-profile case like this to really shine a light on just how ad hoc and informal a lot of these huge decisions are within the board. And Neil, you asked Dr. Gupta, like, if board members need to be evaluated, how is that going to happen? Who is overseeing the body that's supposed to be overseeing stuff?
Maybe that's a project for the blog. I can write them all in individual performance reviews.
Right, but in all seriousness, like, the only body that can do that is the province, which they are supposedly accountable to.
And the province probably doesn't give a shit. Like, they give a shit in that they don't want things to go wrong, but I don't think they're actually examining the performance of governors.
But where does that leave us? I mean, the other solution, which we've talked about before also, is to have a greater number of board members come from the university community itself, well, and that would create a larger degree of accountability.
And really, the model that we should be using is accountability through public scrutiny. Obviously,
it's the only type of accountability anybody cares about.
And obviously, that is the one that they least want to use. We have the solution. They just need to stop being so goddamn secretive all the time and just, like, actually include people in how their decision-making processes go, like they're supposed to.
Okay, but my question is, like, what's within the normal realm of talking to people privately about things that you think, ideas, critiques, in a very normal conversational way? This is how people, people need to be able to talk to each other, right?
But when you talk to your friends about that, do you demand agendas?
I guess my question is, there's always going to be off-book conversations, right?
Yeah, I can admit that.
And there should be, because you cannot develop ideas and gain traction for your ideas if you're always in a formal setting and if you're always being recorded and if notes are being taken. That's just not how you convince people of stuff's work.
Okay, great, but the board doesn't need to be sitting there generating all the ideas. They should be listening to ideas. You're describing a situation where everything just happens in the back rooms, and shouldn't we be happy that that's normal? No, absolutely not. I'm not saying that there won't be backroom conversations happening, but what's so hard about having a decision? Here's what we heard about the decision. This is the decision that we're making, and this is why, based on what we heard. They never do that. The board only has one real responsibility. It's a fundamental one, but it's in the University Act. It's to act in the best interest of the university. The board should be able to complete the sentence for every decision that they make. This decision was in the best interest of the university because.
Yeah, but I have no doubt that these people, you know, probably thought they were acting in the best interest of the university. It's just that they're not seen to be acting in the best interest of the university. It's not just that you do the right thing, but they weren't seen to be doing the right thing, which is probably the bigger part of the problem that you're pointing to, Neil. Mm-hmm. Not the lack of reasoning, but the fact that it is not provided.
That's right. So what did we learn?
I mean, Gupta actually sounded surprisingly upbeat to me.
Well, he didn't say it, but you have to imagine it's a pretty big weight off of his shoulders that he's been carrying around with him for a while. So, I mean, when Jennifer Birdall managed to almost single-handedly take down John Montalbano, that was big. But how about one anonymous Reddit user probably taking down the whole board?
Honestly, Fling Meow, you are the MVP. Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM and podcasted at ubcinsiders.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter, which was burning up this week, at UBC Insiders. Check out the blog, ubcinsiders.ca, or find us on Facebook. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Mayan. We want to mention that we were supposed to talk to Sarah Jane Finley this week about UBC's new approach to sexual assault policy. That interview has been postponed, but we hope to have her on the show at a later date. Next week, we'll be talking to Alex Hemingway, who is one of the students leading the UBC 350 initiative on fossil fuel divestment.
Can't wait. Insiders out.